Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. It's Lockie here. I am at the chair at the moment of an elite team. We have the very lovely Charlie White, who's taken some time away from her foodie stress. It sounds like stress, although I've been in some of it. It's not very stressful if you're there at the Foodies Festival. You get fed cake, lots of it. Boaty Chris is also in the house. But Charlie, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Hey, it's just nice to be getting somebody else feeding me for a change, being off the road.
For sure. Your food is delicious. I recommend everybody go to the Foodies Festival and have some of the cakes made at the bakery tent that Charlotte's running. Chris is not on a boat at the moment. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing very well. A strange experience to have dry feet.
Who's also been running tours out into the Medway and out into the Thames and into the estuary. I've done one of them as well, and they are epic fun. The story today is boaty, and it is very soggy indeed. It's under the water, in fact. Charlotte, what's the story?
Well, I'm really excited about this one. We are joined today by Dr. Benjamin Redding, who is a senior research associate in maritime history in the School of History at the University of East Anglia. His book, The English and French Navies, 1500 to 1650, Expansion, Organisation and State Building, was published in January 2022, and he's contributed to many other works in his specialist fields covering the rise of state navies in early modern military history and maritime culture in Tudor and Stuart Britain. Today, Ben's joining us to discuss his research into the career of the Gloucester and, more importantly, the events surrounding its shipwreck. Though the discovery of the shipwreck may be new news to the public, Ben has spent the last 3 years investigating it, and he's here to tell us what we know about it so far. So hello, Ben.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
We're really excited to talk about the Gloucester. This is some seriously interesting discoveries you've got.
I'm excited to talk about it. It's quite strange after all this time that I'm kind of allowed to let the secret out, so to speak. But it's great, and it's great to be here and finally be able to really talk all things Gloucester.
Fantastic. I mean, it's a pretty big thing to hide, but let's dive straight in, so to speak, and talk about the discovery of the Gloucester beneath the Norfolk waves. What's so special about this shipwreck?
Well, I think kind of if I was to ask what's the unique selling point here, I would say that actually this isn't just a shipwreck, and that's why it's kind of quite important. This wasn't just a warship that was kind of off the sea and gets lost in battle. This is, of course, it is that, but it's also so much more, because it was also used to transport James, Duke of York, the future heir to the throne, from London to Edinburgh. And so it's also a royal shipwreck. And that's what I think is really exciting here. I think that's what makes it unique.
I'm absolutely fascinated by this. From having the little bit that I know about it, it just sounds like such a what if kind of almost like a sliding doors kind of moment, really. But what about the Gloucester herself, first of all, just before we get into kind of the sinking and the events around it, what was the Gloucester? What kind of ship? A big ship, small ship, sailing ship, presumably?
Yes, there's no motors at this point. So, yes, it really quite a sizable ship. So it's known as a third-rate frigate. And actually, this is kind of the type of warship you'd want to be really to be used throughout your fleet in battle, because they could hold a large amount of guns. This kind of warship would have held between 50 and 60 heavy cannon. But quite a large ship, but also it's quite nimble and easy to kind of manoeuvre around the seas. So it's kind of, in many respects, a kind of state-of-the-art warship. So very useful in that respect. What's really interesting about the Gloucester is that it has a long, lengthy career. Of course, the selling point here is what happens in 1682 with the shipwreck itself. But Gloucester is around from 1654 when it's launched all the way until 1682, and it has a really active career. It's involved in the Anglo-Dutch Wars, both the Second and Third Anglo-Dutch Wars. I know a few weeks ago you had a podcast on the Battle of Salt Bay as an example. Mm-hmm. Gloucester's there for that. And so it is a really active warship. I also find a particular interest here is when the Gloucester's launched, one of the very first things it does is sails over to the Caribbean. It's involved in what's known as the Western Design, Oliver Cromwell's Western Design, where it stays in Barbados for quite a while, attempts to attack Hispaniola, and eventually the English settle with Jamaica, taking that off the Spanish. And the Gloucester's there for almost 2 years. So right from the outset, the ship being launched, it's a really active warship. And actually that makes it a really important warship kind of for the history of England and later Britain.
Was it always called Gloucester? Because I know that a lot of Cromwell's ships were renamed in honour of the royal family. So I wondered if it was named after Henry, Duke of Gloucester.
Right. So, you're nearly there in this. So as it was launched in 1654, it was part of a wider shipbuilding scheme in which many warships at the time were named after big Civil War battles, parliamentary victories. And the Gloucester was one of those. So it was named after the 1643 siege of Gloucester, a parliamentary victory. We think the reason why it isn't renamed in 1616, you're quite right, many of the warships are. The reason behind this is probably because of Henry, Duke of Gloucester. One of the warships, the Master More of the Cromwellian period, is renamed. It's renamed York after James, Duke of York. Most likely that in the case of Gloucester, the reason why it's not renamed is because, yes, it's named after Charles's younger brother.
We've talked about other ships of this period on the podcast before, like Royal Charles and HMS London that blew up off in the estuary. How does Gloucester stack up compared to those two?
Well, both of those warships were larger than the Gloucester, for a start. I believe the Royal Charles was a first-rate frigate, and the London was a second-rate. So they were both larger, an extra gun deck, more guns. That in itself is interesting because it usually meant that a larger ship would be more expensive to run, operate, and so therefore it's at sea less frequently. So that's something to bear in mind there. Gloucester would have been used more for that reason. It's cheaper to run. Those warships were kind of the, I guess you call them like the flagships, so to speak. They were the big obstacles in war that were there to attract attention, and that you'd often get kind of the admirals clashing between. I guess the point of comparison, both of those warships have tragic ends in the same way Gloucester does, of course. Royal Charles, of course, with the Battle of Medway, if you call that a tragic end, it then it stays in the Dutch Republic for the rest of its life. And of course, the London tragically explodes on the Thames. So they all have kind of tragic endings in that respect. What makes Gloucester different, though, is its third rate. It's slightly smaller, would be used more. It's kind of a more of a nimble weapon of war in that respect.
It's a little runaround, the Gloucester.
Punchy runaround, though, I want to say. It's almost like a quick cruiser or something, isn't it?
With this said, there are still certainly many warships that are a lot smaller than it that would even be even more kind of quick and nimble. But there were reports when Gloucester was launched, actually, it's quite a fast ship that can sail quickly. And that was reflected on when it was crossing over to the Caribbean. It was perceived that way as a good sailor.
Well, let's jump in on kind of what she had on board then at the time of her sinking, because it doesn't get much more high profile than James, Duke of York, heir to the throne, does it? Because really he's only ranked second to the king himself. There must have been a lot of fancy stuff on board, mustn't there? Did he have any personal belongings and valuable things?
You'd certainly think so, yes. So first thing to reflect on with the Gloucester sinking is that it was actually packed, really packed with people. It had a full crew of kind of around 260 to 280 crew. And in addition to that, it has lots and lots of passengers, royal passengers, courtiers such as John Churchill, George Legge, and then of course all their servants as well. So loads and loads of people on board, very packed and busy, and you'd expect people of this kind of class to yes indeed bring in many of the valuables so that they could live in style on board. And one thing we are particularly interested in with the Gloucester shipwreck is trying to uncover that the stern castle of the ship is still under sand. And we believe that that is where James Duke of York would have been staying at the time. So that's kind of a real kind of hopeful moment for the future, that because that the stern castle ship is still under the sandbank, that's probably where loads of those nice, fancy kind of items are kept to pursue for the future.
Why was James Duke of York going to Scotland? Why was the Gloucester chosen to take him there?
So it's actually part of a much bigger issue that kind of sweeps over Restoration England, and is connected to the exclusion crisis and the Popish plot at the time. So really why James is going, you have to understand why he's going to Scotland, you have to step back several years earlier. James had converted to Catholicism at some point in the early 1670s, and it was made public knowledge by 1673. When he is forced to resign as admiral because of his Catholic faith. People had to denounce mass in order to hold public office at that time, and James refused to do so. So he was a very public Catholic. And that's important because in the late 1670s, we have what's called the Popish Plot, where there was a mass amount of hysteria and conspiracy that Catholics were out to kill the king. And the result was a bigger issue called the Exclusion Crisis. What the exclusion crisis meant was that James, who was the next in line to the throne, was a Catholic, and they attempted to remove him from the line of succession for his Catholic beliefs. There were many prominent individuals within Parliament who refused to kind of harbour the idea of a Catholic taking over the throne of a Protestant country. And the exclusion crisis attempted to pass a bill to remove James from the line of the throne, and probably to put in his place Charles II's illegitimate son, James Scott, the Duke of Monmouth, who was a Protestant. And in 1679, as a way to kind of attempt to relieve the crisis, to kind of let things simmer, Charles essentially forces his brother to move to Edinburgh and to reside there. And on and off the next 3 years, that's where James and his family remain. And that stays that way until March 1682, when Charles invites only James back to England as a way to kind of test the waters, because he believes that this crisis has kind of finally ended, and that Parliament had almost been defeated, and that James would now be accepted as the heir to the throne. So in March 1682, James arrives in England alone. He first meets his brother at Newmarket, and it seems he's well received, and then travels to London. And only when he's in London, Charles says, okay, we seem confident here that things should be okay. And that's when the Gloucester is requested to actually bring James back to Scotland, because his wife's still there, his pregnant wife at that, and his daughter Anne as well. And so James was actually going to Scotland to kind of settle all affairs there and to collect his family, because he was finally going to be able to reside permanently in England again to become the future King of England.
It's also helpful that Charles had sent his Parliament home in 1681 and hadn't called them back, so he wasn't getting so much hassle on that, so he could probably afford to see his brother again.
Absolutely, although perhaps reluctantly, they certainly had a relationship that was one of kind of conflicting personalities, shall we say. The very fact that Charles, who is of course known as the Merry Monarch, quite laid back, The fact that he was willing to dissolve Parliament during the exclusion crisis reflects really just how bad the situation was. It really could have ended quite differently for James.
All right, so the ship is requested. Where did it sail from?
So there's an interesting story here with the Gloucester, because it had very recently been refitted, almost rebuilt. It'd been in dock for almost 3 years in the late 1670s, which had finished it by mid to late 1680. And that rebuild had took place in Portsmouth.
Right.
By late 1681, early 1682, there's talk of, hey, let's actually use this warship. They're not officially at war at this point, although there's certainly kind of tension with Catholic France. And it's decided that the Gloucester is going to be fitted for sea. But the initial idea is not to use it for this idea of going to Scotland. The idea is that it's going to travel to the Mediterranean. It's going to be used as a part of a kind of convoy to protect Tangier, which at this time is an English territory. And Captain Sir John Berry is selected as its captain. And it just has so happens that at this time, as Gloucester is preparing for sea, when it's just about ready to be launched, James needs a taxi. And so it's and it's quickly kind of changes course, shall we say, and takes part in this world progress instead. It's almost by chance that it happens.
So I'm kind of thinking about this, like, what is the kind of ship you would want for something like this? And it's got to be, you know, this is small fry, isn't it? This is small potatoes, this journey. This is a ship that sailed the Atlantic at least twice. It's seen action off the coast of East Anglia. So, you know, this is territory that the kind of people know well, of course. How in the world does it end up sinking off the coast of Norfolk?
You're quite right. I mean, it's almost bizarre that this warship would be used for this kind of trip. And the fact that it is a reflection of actually how important this voyage is for James, because he's making a statement that he's back. it's this big statement of that. He's defeated those who tried to oust him from the line of succession. And they therefore using this large third-rate frigate is a statement of that. It's powerful. And of course, Gloucester wasn't alone. A small squadron also accompanies the ship. We have the Dartmouth, the Pearl, the Ruby, several yachts all accompany Gloucester on this trip. And I think that's partially the reason why the Gloucester's selected. It's a large warship that's just been refitted for sea. James, by being on board, can make this statement of, I am powerful and I am back. I think that's particularly important. Strangely enough, though, using a third rate probably isn't the best decision. It's usually much smaller craft that sail over to Scotland, partially because of the kind of conditions and the climate, the weather, but also because of various sandbanks and having to navigate around them. Having a warship that's really quite of a large size is quite dangerous because of various sandbanks that has to navigate around. There's always a potential that it could strike one of these sandbanks because of kind of the large holding of water that it displaces. And lo and behold, look what happened.
I mean, putting James as the former Lord High Admiral, I guess for him having a ship of that calibre, it sort of reinforces a little bit of his seafaring status, doesn't it?
That's right. And that's one thing I think we often forget about James. We think of him first as kind of almost a bad monarch. Mm. But he was actually really quite passionate about the Navy. And when he was forced to resign in 1673, you can imagine it was done really reluctantly. He was passionate about the sea and was one of the individuals who was keen to kind of institutionalise it, to set out various rules and regulations for conduct. He is a future king who's on the battlefield at Sole Bay, so it reflects that he's someone who really is interested in the Navy, and I have no doubt that with him returning to power in 1682, he was also quite hoping that it would also result in his influence over the navy also kind of developing. And there's no surprise that when he becomes king in 1685, one of the first acts he does is actually to reinvent himself as a Lord High Admiral again.
Yeah. I always wanted to be in the room when Charles grounded him after, I think it was the Battle of Lowestoft, when three men got exploded with the same cannonball next to James. And he has to ground him because he's his only heir. And I just imagine this real seafaring guy who's been, he's been titular Lord High Admiral since he was five. So he's been born for this, to be grounded by his big brother. I just always imagine this being a real source of tension between the two of them.
That's right. And it's probably got interesting parallels with, of course, what happens in the exclusion crisis when essentially Charles grounds them again to Scotland. but you can sense the kind of fraught relationship that these two had. That's a really interesting case you provided there with Lowestoft. And it does reflect that although James is very experienced at sea, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's kind of the best at sea. And he had many critics. As an example, at the Battle of Solebay, James is forced to swap ships three times during the battle. And he's criticised as actually being too slow to act when he's kind of removing himself from one ship and going on to the other. He was someone who had a strict perception of how the Navy should operate, that his rule and order and how the Navy should be organised in line of battles, that his word should be of paramount importance and no one should ever cross him in that. It's perhaps a view that really was quite misleading and inappropriate, because it led to many criticisms, and it reflects on a concept of kind of the ship of state. If this is a monarch and this is how he controls his navy, how would he be when it comes 1685, when he has that kind of iron grip over the kingdom himself? If he's trying to state that the navy should operate to the click of his fingers, is that going to reflect indeed on how he rules in 1685? And indeed, perhaps it did, because, of course, he was seen as kind of an absolutist monarch in the way that Louis XIV wished to be kind of viewed in kind of universal monarchy.
So looking at the sinking then, specifically, the fact that he did have this status and this connection with the Navy, is there a kind of element of hubris to the sinking, in the sense of an I know best, we're going this way sort of way? And then when, you know, things, you know, do, when they do strike the sandbank, is it an immediate kind of, oh, got that wrong, right, better get all the important stuff and all the people off kind of thing, and let's manage this in a responsible way? Or is there any more kind of, well, we're just going to truck on regardless?
I think, knowing James as we do now, he was very unlikely to kind of put his hands up and go, yeah, it was my fault, my blunder. Actually, it was quite the opposite in that as what actually happened. And really, James, in many respects, was to blame for the events that occurred before Gloucester strikes the sandbank. So they are travelling on the Gloucester, and they hit a particularly notorious set of sandbanks off of the North Norfolk coast, and they're known as being particularly dynamic as well, with these sandbanks constantly changing their appearance and movement over time, and they're not very well kind of charted on the maps. Traditionally, a smaller vessel would kind of hug the coastline, follow Great Yarmouth, and they would do that largely because they can see kind of the they can see clear natural kind of satellites to detect where exactly they are. They can see sandbanks, and they can see churches, and they can see various beaches, and through that they know exactly where they are. That's usually what a pilot would like to do. But because the Gloucester was a larger warship, they were concerned that travelling so close to the coastline would actually result in it perhaps kind of grounding on the shallow seas. And so there was an argument that took place on the evening before Gloucester wrecked on the 5th of May. And the argument was over which course it should take. The pilot still wanted to hug that coastline. James thought that was much too risky with such a large warship, and he thought they should actually kind of sail in between some of the sandbanks. Whereas the master of the ship, who was called Benjamin Holmes, who really actually had should have overall say in things, because as navigator of the ship, he wanted to sail as far out as possible, completely missing all the sandbanks, and then kind of once they're cleared, then to kind of come back closer to the shore. That was a big argument, and you could probably guess who got their way at the end. It was James. So that decision is made that they're going to try and take that middle route. But when the decision is made, everyone decides to go to bed, James included. They go to bed, only leaving the pilot, who didn't wish to take this route, to lead that course. And it didn't end well, as you can see with the announcement recently made of the discovery. It did indeed hit one of the sandbanks in the early hours in the morning. So in that respect, you can say maybe James was to blame for that. He kind of decided that final route to take, and then went to bed. So and so in many respects, it was his fault. And another point to kind of point the finger at here with James is that when the ship does strike the sandbank, it would usually be protocol for James, as the most senior official on board, to decide, now we need to abandon ship. But James didn't abandon ship until the very last minute when it was going down. He felt that the ships could still be saved. And because of protocol at the time, no one else could leave the ship until James left the ship. And so it took 45 minutes from the ship striking the sandbank to it sinking. And James didn't leave for over half an hour. And so really, in many respects, the scale of casualties was a result of him.
Wow. How many people lost their lives, do we think, on the Gloucester?
So numbers are varied because there is no, unfortunately, there's no muster list that survived. Muster list would have been held with the purse of the ship from the time, and so it would be very soggy now, shall we say. But records suggest that the crew was around 260 people, and in addition to that, there were a large amount of passengers and servants. We suspect that this was probably in the range, therefore around 330 and 350 people on the Gloucester at the time, and over half of those would have lost their lives on board. We have records for at least between 60 and 70 crew who died, whose names we actually have. And that's in addition to a large amount of servants and to many high status individuals, nobles. The Earl of Roxburgh died on board. Several Scottish nobles and gentry members died, as well as their servants.
And you said John Churchill, the future Duke of Marlborough, was on board as well.
He was. So he was at this time James's right-hand man, essentially. And he accompanied James and was with him on the rowboat when they kind of depart. John Churchill was there to protect James. He raised his sword to ensure that no one else climbed in his little rowboat with James on board in an attempt to kind of topple it over. When it's sailing off, it was a very dangerous event, and John Churchill was essentially kind of saving his prince. It was kind of it was an honourable thing he would have perceived it to do. But it's quite vile in many respects, and a lot of lives were lost because of it.
Gosh, I wonder if things might have turned out differently for James if John Churchill had gone down with the ship as well.
Well, there are arguments that still exist today that this event may indeed have triggered something in John Churchill's mind that resulted in kind of turning in 1688. You know, he saw James at this time, and so it seemed clearly vulnerable and reflected that this actually probably isn't the best of leaders. It probably would have influenced what happened in 1688, because clearly people's lives could have been saved if James had acted differently at this point, even if he wasn't indeed the sole kind of individual who's culpable for the disaster.
What exactly sort of inspired the search specifically for Gloucester? I mean, like we said, there's shipwrecks all around the country, literally everywhere. Why exactly did you guys go for Gloucester, and how did you go about finding her?
So the Gloucester was discovered in 2007 by brothers Julian and Lincoln Barnwell and their friend James Little. and they'd actually been looking for the ship for around 4 years. They have a great passion for diving on historic shipwrecks, and had generally been used to kind of diving on kind of 20th century shipwrecks generally. And then one day, Lincoln Barnwell had this book on historic shipwrecks and found a reference to the Gloucester and the word cannon, and got excited by the idea of a royal shipwreck. And so, and then off they went, and they attempted it. Took 4 years, I believe it was around 5,000 nautical miles in attempt to discover it. So it took quite some time. And then one day, yes, indeed, they got, I guess we could say lucky, because you say, well, they kind of worked relentlessly to discover it. And yes, they did indeed. And I believe the first sight they, you know, they saw this cannon. If you've seen the image that's been released of the site, you see all these fantastic cannon all scattered around. And yeah, I think I'm sure they got extremely excited immediately thereafter.
Yeah, no, I would be. The big brass cannons.
So that's actually yet to be determined on some, because with these cannons, they haven't brought any up. They're particularly heavy, and at the moment, the only kind of items that have been recovered have been rescue archaeology, and usually cannons will survive the test of time, it would appear, at least at the moment. It's most likely that there would be both brass and iron cannon down there, as that was the system at the time. It's also most probable that some of these cannon were really quite old. It would not surprise me if some of them range on 60, 70 years of age, and that would be the kind of bronze ones, most probably, yes.
I mean, it's really exciting to see things coming up, and you know, like the bell, which was the sort of almost like the ID tag that told you it was the Gloucester. What's been brought up so far? Is there anything really cool that's come up so far? And what does it tell us about who was on board this ship other than the hoi polloi?
you're right. So the bell was used to identify the ship as Gloucester. It has 1681 on it. So, you know, it's pretty firm evidence there. And of course, back then, the calendar 1681 could have gone all the way to March 1682 when the new year officially started. So that's really quite nice evidence there to confirm. And that bell, we believe, was made by the Wainwright brothers in London. So it's got a lovely mark on it. Mm-hmm. And it's a really beautiful piece. So for me, some of the most interesting finds are probably to do with the wine that's been discovered, which, again, is not something you usually expect to find with a warship, which kind of reflects that this was far more than that. So far, around 150 bottles have been rescued from the ship. So 150 wine bottles, which really reflects that they were having a good time on board.
And my really kind celebrating. Of ship.
Exactly. Yes, we've said it's essentially a party ship in many respects, which it was. Strange to celebrate in being returning finally. Yes, so there's 150 wine bottles or thereabouts recovered so far, and around 30 of them still have the original wine contents in. And not only the wine contents, they have a new word for me, they have what's called the ullage, which is the airlock in the bottle, which means that the wine hasn't been contaminated either. And so that's the kind of thing that really interests me and excites me, because so we have not only 17th century wine, we have 17th century air as well.
Are you a booze historian as well, Ben?
I should be. This is something coming up. It's as long as it comes with free samples.
Yeah, do you think we could, I mean, could we, in theory, I mean, obviously a small select group, basically us four, could we, in theory, taste that wine?
Well, I've been told it's probably not the best of ideas, because the wine is quite low alcohol percentage because they were drinking so much of it. It was around 5% back then, and now it's only around kind of 1-2% as it's gone over the years. And so because of that, it's probably not going to, it's going to give you certainly a poorly belly, shall we say, when drinking it. But that doesn't mean it's not useful for us. Where hopefully in the future, scientific research can do stuff like tell us where the wine comes from. What country does it originate from? That's something that really interests me, yeah. Because when we think of wine, we usually think of kind of French wine as kind of the state of the art example, and it was associated that way then. But in the late 1670s and early 1680s, French wine was actually banned in England for its association with Catholicism. So what I'm really interested to find out is this wine still French wine? And something tells me James wouldn't really have cared. And it's quite possible that they would have still been drinking French wine and kind of bending the rules, shall we say. One rule for them, another rule for us. So that to me is really exciting on what kind of can come out of this shipwreck. So yeah, the wine to me is the most exciting find. But of course, there are many other objects. A lot of work has gone into two chests that have been found down there. And we've been working to try and identify whose kind of chest this would have been. Who would have, so we've got stuff like navigational tools, dividers that have come for it. But there are also clothes, shoes, a woman's hood that's been discovered. And so there is so much to kind of get out of these. And yes, it's interesting what's been recovered so far and what hopefully these items can tell us. But in the future, through research, but also we've got to be excited about what's still down there. Because this ship was so packed with people, there's got to be a lot of really interesting stuff that would tell us things we've just never known before. How was a warship packed when it had royals and nobles on board? What would they have carried? They're not carrying backpacks, of course. These are the kind of questions that hopefully Gloucester will really open her eyes to in the future.
Gosh. Wasn't one of the wine bottles marked with a rather interesting family crest for our American listeners?
That's right. So we believe it has the crest of the Washington family on. And one of the passengers on board was George Legge, who was, if you kind of consider John Churchill to be the right-hand man of James, George Legge was the left. And and he's a really important individual, actually, who even in 1688 sides with James, and he's actually the admiral who controls the English Navy when William Orange is crossing the Channel. So he's quite an important historical figure. And George Legge, his mother was Elizabeth Washington, who was an ancestor of course, George Washington, the president of the first president of the United States. And yes, we have this lovely bottle that has this crest, which we believe to be that Washington, that Washington crest. And to kind of further reflect on that, George Legge, he actually integrates the Washington crest into his own coat of arms anyway. So it is a kind of symbol of him.
We've heard that the wreck itself has been described as kind of like the single most significant historic maritime discovery since the raising of the Mary Rose. From what you're saying, this sounds like quite a fair comparison.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. In ways, it's unfair to compare it to the Mary Rose because it's so different. Of course, you know, it's a warship that sinks nearly 150 years later, but most importantly, it's that royal dimension that makes it really, really exciting, right? As a naval historian, I can't wait to find out what this warship can tell us about how ships were constructed, what kind of equipment they had on board, what were in the chests, perhaps, of the officers, such as the captains and the pilots. Those kind of things are really exciting to uncover. But we also have to reflect that actually this isn't just a naval find. It's a find of significant importance to politics and culture. I believe it does certainly deserve its place in being compared to the Mary Rose for that reason.
What sort of condition is it in? I mean, is it comparable to the Mary Rose in terms of the state that it's in? Is it going to be, I don't know, are you going to float the thing? Is it coming up?
So future research and funding obviously will help us to kind of answer this question. And so at the moment, there is no direct answer on whether the ship can be fully recovered. Of course, a maritime historian, I've got to keep my fingers crossed. But we will, I guess we will see is the true answer on that. It would be fantastic if it could, of course. Let's see. A trust has currently been established under Lord General Richard Dannett, and that will kind of help to push that forward for us to be able to tell, hope in the future, what is possible. As to the state of the wreck as it stands, my understanding is it's probably quite comparable to the Mary Rose. Think of it as an open book, and you can see all its kind of various decks. It's laying flat, and I think it is quite similar in that way. Part of the ship has corroded over has decayed over time, but it's left the ship open, very much like the Mary Rose is. Wow.
Gosh, it's fantastic. We actually asked our we've got another boaty friend at History Hack, the historian J.D. Davis, who's written about Pepys' Navy and written about the navies of Charles II. And he told us the wreck of the Gloucester isn't just a fantastic time capsule of the Restoration period. It undoubtedly changed the history of the British Isles. It's just such an exciting project to be a part of.
And indeed, that quote reflects not just on the wreck, but actually how important this ship is to the history and its career. As mentioned earlier, with the Western design as an example, it's really exciting. I'm certainly very lucky to kind of be on board on this journey. But I think this warship has a lot of potential and hopefully become a major cultural heritage point for the future.
In terms of cultural heritage, I mean, I'm still thinking about our wine, Ben, if I'm honest with you. And I'm thinking about the swag that must be down there. So what will happen to these artefacts when they're brought up? Who owns them technically, and will we get to see them?
I was thinking, is it like anything on land, and the British Museum would get first shout, wouldn't it? I don't know if it quite works the same way at sea or not.
So technical policy is that these objects remain the property of the Ministry of Defence. So it's kind of very heavily political in that respect. But if in the future, through research, we find certain items and we can trace those items to a specific individual, for example the leg bottle is an example, then those items become the crowns, and then they could be in discussions to actually be returned or discussed with their relatives. So that's kind of where that goes. As to the actual objects that have been discovered so far, the big plan is that in February 2023 a exhibition will be held at Norfolk Museum Services, specifically in Norfolk Castle, Norwich Castle. And that will host some of the various finds that have kind of been discovered so far. I have no doubt that there will be plenty of wine there. And that they will be kind of in conversation with various kind of items from other museums that we hope to kind of acquire via loans, that together will tell the story of the Gloucester and show to the public for the first time some of the fantastic finds that have been uncovered so far.
That sounds completely epic. I love a nice East Anglian story anyway, being East Anglian myself. And sounds like a good excuse to come up and drink some wine. I don't know. Wine. We keep talking about wine. I don't know. I'm going to have to go and open a bottle soon. It sounds like the story's just getting started. I know, from the discovery some years ago, now it's public, now it's out there, and now we're away, aren't we? We're rumbling. How can we keep up to date with the story as it develops and what's happening with the Gloucester, and how can we support the project?
So a website has been launched, which is www.gloucestershipwreck.co.uk, and that website concerns the history of the warship, and that's part of a wider historical research project which consists of Professor Claire Jowett and I, and we're currently writing a kind of cradle to grave history of the Gloucester warship. And so if you'd like further information on the history of the ship, I'd recommend going there. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @GloucesterWreck. And hopefully that will continue to be kind of busy and expand in the future. As to how you can support, well, a good start will be next year when the exhibition comes out. It will be around from February to July 2023. And I obviously would love everyone to come and see how fantastic the Gloucester truly is. As already mentioned, a trust is also in development. And any kind of donations or funding for that, I'm sure, would be greatly appreciated to continue work on the Gloucester. A charity will be set up for that. And currently, the University of East Anglia, working under its own charity, is holding donations to the course.
Fantastic. Well, it goes without saying that we will be there the minute we are allowed in to come and see this stuff. I think the three of us will be down there to come and check it out, because it really is just the most exciting discovery.
You would be more than welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Benjamin Redding. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you to Chris Sams for being our boaty expert enthusiast naval nerd.
Thanks. It's nice to get invited out. Naval historians don't get asked to parties.
There's a reason for that, Chris.
It might just be me.
And thank you, Lockie.
Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.